Welcome to the Atomic Podcast. Whether you're a nurse anesthesia resident in CRNA school or an RN trying to get there, you're in the right place.
I'm Sachi, and along with Rhea, we're going to talk all things anesthesia and science, and we're going to bring along some of our friends too.
Join us each week as we dive into all things science and anesthesia. All right, so welcome to another episode of the Atomic Anesthesia Podcast. Today we have a really awesome guest, Dr. Tom Barrett, and he has an amazing professional background in opioid-free anesthesia. Now, a lot of people around the country do practice opioid-free anesthesia, but there are a lot of people around the country that do not and are interested in learning more about it, especially residents that are in training and even experienced CRNAs that work in practices that maybe have high opioid use and they want to transition or learn a little bit more about how to perform or practice opioid-free anesthesia, especially when they come across certain patients that may require it. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your professional background and how you got into this topic in this field.
You know, it's kind of a funny story. When I was in anesthesia, my anesthesia program, one of the things that we had to do was do an hour-long presentation in front of the anesthesia group. And we had, at the time, there was an anesthesiologist who was really into Esmolol infusions to reduce opioid use and postoperative pain. And really just took it to the extreme. So we would do like a total knee replacement under spinal anesthesia and, would have to run an Esmolol infusion, which, you know, at the time to me didn't make any sort of sense at all. And so I decided to actually look up what all the research was on Esmolol infusions and present that to the anesthesia group. And my sort of underhanded intention was to show that, maybe what we were doing wasn't the best thing and didn't make a lot of sense. But what happened is there wasn't enough research on that for an entire hour. So my presentation, you know, I expanded it to cover sort of all the multimodal medications, Tylenol, NSAIDs, ketamine, lidocaine infusions, magnesium, and the pain pathways and the mechanisms that each of them utilized. And so then my first job out of school, we were just getting into the ERAS world and starting to use a lot of these modalities. You know, we were doing a lot of blocks, we were doing a lot of lidocaine infusion, we were starting to use a lot of ketamine. And, you know, with each additional modality that I adopted, the amount of fentanyl I was giving was less and less. And eventually, you know, it got to the point where for the entire case, I was giving 25 to 50 mics of fentanyl on induction, and that was it. And, you know, if you have the mindset that, you know, we're trying to avoid the side effect of opioids, and logically, you know, that 50 mics of fentanyl, what is that doing 2 to 3 hours later? Absolutely nothing. So why am I still giving it? And so one day with sort of trembling hands, because I had never given an anesthetic without opioids, like the vast majority of us, right? That's one side right. of the anesthetic triangle is opioids, you know, and I even like drew it up, labeled it, set it on the anesthesia machine. And I sort of rationalized to myself, well, you know, what's the worst case scenario? You know, I induce, I put the tube in, they get a little tachycardic, I reach over and I give it, right? And you know, shockingly, I went through induction, nothing happened, nothing bad happened. And I got to the end of the case and the patient breathed a whole lot better than, you know, all the other cases where I had given it. Patients woke up more clear-headed, they had less nausea, they had less pain. And so then I started having to just go down this rabbit hole of literature and find, well, why when I give when I withhold the pain medication, do my patients have less pain postoperatively? And I discovered that, you know, there was this, all this research had been done on opioid-free anesthesia already. And I just sort of was discovering it because no one had exposed it to me.
That's really interesting. And so as you start to tell and research more about this and tell people about this, you found other clinicians, it seems, that were going through this own kind of journey, right, on their own. And so, for example, you know, Craig Vanna, right? And you were telling me about how you two met and started discussing maybe we should create a society around this to educate other clinicians about this practice. And so you and some other CRNAs had created the Society for Opioid-Free Anesthesia, also called SOFA. So we'll get into a little bit about SOFA in a minute, but, you know, why, before we get into that, you know, why should clinicians consider adding this to their practice? And maybe could you talk a little bit about some of the benefits that are supported by literature for opioid-free anesthesia?
Yeah, absolutely. So opioid-free anesthesia was invented or discovered as a way to mitigate respiratory depression in an anesthetic. That was the very first paper that was written on it. It was bariatric patients having open gastric sleeves. So you had morbidly obese patients who were having very painful procedures that lasted 3 to 5 hours, and they were having a significant percentage of them that they were unable to get off the ventilator afterwards. And so a group of anesthetists came up with this idea, well, what if we do this sort of multimodal analgesia and leave the opioids out? And, you know, so from the very first paper, what's been demonstrated is that there's significantly less respiratory depression with opioid-free anesthesia. So what's been sort of discovered since then is that there's also dramatically less postoperative nausea and vomiting when you don't have the combination of opioids and volatile gases at the same time. Pain, this is like 50-50 when you talk about pain, whether you kind of have equal amounts of pain postoperatively or less pain postoperatively. And a lot of that depends on the technique and how you do opioid-free anesthesia, what medications you use, when you turn them off, what doses. You know, it's a little bit like saying regional anesthesia. If you say I did regional anesthesia on a patient, that doesn't really describe what you did. And so pain's a little bit of a tricky one. But one of the things that the more recent studies are focusing on is length of hospital stay and being able to get patients out of the hospital faster with opioid-free anesthesia. And actually, I wrote a paper with Kevin Keller and some CRNAs down in Atlanta who were able to use opioid-free anesthesia to successfully do outpatient radical robotic prostatectomies. And so that's one of the great benefits when you're talking to hospital administration and things like that, is when you can save the hospital inpatient days, when you can do cases outpatient that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do, you know, that's a huge benefit.
Speaking to them more in the dollars and cents, as opposed to just talking about symptoms as well. So you said they're going to have potentially decreased hospital stay, which saves money and time. More patients are able to go outpatient because we're not worried so much about respiratory depression. Overall, less respiratory depression and less nausea and vomiting.
Correct. Yeah.
Are there some major cons to doing opioid-free anesthesia?
So, I mean, To my mind, no, but you have to be careful doing opioid-free anesthesia because you're giving a lot of long-acting medications that have a sedative effect to them. So it can be very easy to over-sedate your patients and have patients who require several hour stays in PACU. So that's the biggest side effect. You know,
Which medications do you see that with most? Is that like the ketamine,
Precedex? Precedex both, yeah. You know, have that sort of side effect profile in giving those in combination. And especially as you have some more elderly patients, it can be very easy to overshoot the mark there.
I would say a good portion of clinicians, and I read this on, you know, some of our social media groups or in talking with people, that kind of get a negative view about opioid-free anesthesia. Why do you think that so many people, I don't want to say so many people, but why do you think there's a group of people out there that are very strongly against it? Do you think that it's maybe a lack of understanding the research behind it, or why do you think there's this bias against it?
Sure. I think the first thing that I come across is just a little bit of fear, right? You know, you go to school, you learn a way to do it, you do it for 20 to 30 years every day, and then someone comes out and says, that's not a good way to do it. You know, you're hurting your patients by giving them the opioids. And so I think that even if that's not the message that people are trying to convey, I think that's sometimes the message that people hear, you know, and people take a lot of pride in giving a good anesthetic and in their technique and what they're able to accomplish with that. So I think there's a lot of that. I think there is, for people who haven't read the research, you know, there's sort of this sense of, you know, of we exist on this pendulum of opioid use and going from, you know, the high opioid techniques, you know, that came about in the 60s and 70s, you know, and they've seen it go through multimodal therapy and then the ERAS programs. And now people are saying, well, don't give any opioids at all. And there's sort of a feeling out there that maybe have we gone too far, which is not what the literature shows. And I think there's also a misunderstanding of the point of opioid-free anesthesia. We talk a lot about opioid-free anesthesia is really an intraoperative technique designed to reduce the major complications of anesthesia, right? Respiratory depression, nausea, and pain. It's like the three things that if we're going to have a complication, it's going to be related to one of those three things. And so if you're not educated about that fact, you think that this is just an attempt to reduce opioid use for its own sake, or it's a response to the opioid epidemic and an attempt to reduce addiction. And they don't realize what the actual anesthetic benefits of the technique are. And so then it's easy to get sort of a negative feeling that this is a knee-jerk reaction to the opioid epidemic or the addiction epidemic, or just a pointless attempt to reduce opioid use overall. And then if the patient's going to get post-operative opioid use, is there really a benefit to it? So I think a lot of misunderstanding about what our goals are with opioid-free anesthesia.
Mm-hmm. I think that from what I went talking to people, it seems that they think that opioid, not everyone, but some people think that opioid-free anesthesia just literally means cutting the opioid out and not really adding anything in. And the technique that you're going to walk us through really shows that, you know, you do have to replace the opioid with quite a few medications to be able to accomplish that pain-free experience. Mm-hmm. But so somebody tries it once, they might not have really perfected their technique yet. The patient's having a lot of pain in PACU, and that's it. They're like, see, I told you it doesn't work. And you're like, well, you know, you have to get better too.
Exactly. And, you know, when you look at the literature, there's a little bit of confusion there too, because there's really kind of like three stages that it happened in. And the first stage was using beta blockers or placebo versus opioids. And while they were able to show like less respiratory depression, less nausea, there wasn't a lot of effects on pain. And then they switched to using Precedex as the sole intraoperative analgesic. And, you know, you had less respiratory depression, less nausea, less pain, but the patients took 2 to 3 hours to wake up, you know, with the doses of Precedex that were necessary. And it's only more recently that we've sort of really gotten into a multimodal technique to treat pain. And when you start looking at pain and you think about how many different receptors and pathways and neurotransmitters are involved in the treatment of pain, it's bonkers to think that there's just a single drug that we're going to give that's going to adequately treat that entire pain pathway. And that's what we find with opioid-free anesthesia. And when you treat that pathway at multiple points along its along the transmission of pain, it doesn't take very much of any medication. You can use very low doses of all the different medications to get this incredibly dense analgesia.
So going into now the technique, and I think this is what people are really the most, and they're like, come on, just get to it. So the thing that people are the most interested in is how. And could you walk us through, well, just how we would do it for a case, walk us through your routine for pre-op, intra-op, and post-operatively? Because I know that with how these medications work, the mechanism of action, the timing is something that you have to take into consideration. And some of these medications need to be started in the holding area. I don't think many people realize that, because the onset is not immediate the same way that opioids are. You have to kind of get this plan together and get this started before the patient even comes back to the operating room. So could you walk us through your routine and what works for you, and really go into details about the drug, the dosage, and the timing?
Yeah. So the first thing that I want to put out there is I think a lot of people get really intimidated by the fact that we're talking about, you know, 3 to 5 different analgesic medications. And they think, gosh, I'm giving like all these different medications for this one case. But really, it ends up being sort of the same number of medications that you would give for a standard anesthetic. They're just slightly different medications that we're not quite as familiar with. And so don't get overwhelmed by the number of medications that you're giving. So typically what I will do is I've replaced my Versed use with Precedex. And Precedex is a great anxiolytic, and it's also a great analgesic. But the difficult part Precedex is it has about a 10-minute onset time. It takes about 10 minutes to get to its peak effect. And so you really want to start loading Precedex as early as possible. And so what I'll do is I'll get a syringe and I'll dilute it down to about 10 mics per milliliter. And so when I go and get my patient from pre-op, I'll start my loading dose of Precedex actually in pre-op, the same way you would give a little bit of Versed as you start rolling back to the operating room. And so this has two effects, right? It gives the patient a nice analgesic, and it also starts getting that analgesia on board. So by the time I do my induction, the analgesic effects are already there. And the other nice thing about Precedex is you don't have to worry about age with it. You don't have to worry, well, I've got an 80-year-old patient, this is going to contribute to postoperative cognitive dysfunction, you can still give it to those elderly patients.
And there's a lot of research to support that precedent actually may have some neuroprotective properties to it as well. So maybe the most appropriate medication to give.
Exactly. Yeah. And like the three, I think, key patient populations there are pediatrics, elderly, and your military patients or anyone with PTSD. Those three patient populations, especially, it's been shown to reduce postoperative cognitive dysfunction. And so, like, but really, I mean, it's good for everyone.
Can you say the state the dose again for this use?
Yeah. So weight-based dosing is about a half mic per kilo. So anywhere 25 to 50 mics. And you know, sort of the dirty secret of anesthesia is we report everything in weight-based dosing. But clinically, we give it based on age and health of the patient, right? So, you know, anywhere from 25 to 50 mics. And, you know, I will push 10 mics at a time about every minute to 2 minutes till I get to that dose. So then we get our patient back to the operating room, get them over on the table, put the monitors on, start pre-oxygenating them. And we're going to give a bigger dose of lidocaine than we would normally give, a full 2 milligrams per kilo. And we're going to give a 0.5 milligram per kilo of ketamine with our propofol, our rocuronium, whatever other medications you're going to give for induction. And if you've gotten the Precedex on board early enough, that dose of ketamine, the big dose of lidocaine on top of that, that's going to be adequate to block the sympathetic response from laryngoscopy. Typically, it's rare to have to redose. You may have to give a little bit more on incision, but typically that'll be adequate for incision. And because they're such long-lasting medication, that's going to give you, you know, an hour to 2 hours that you don't really have to worry about the analgesic side of things. Now, in the anesthesia world, we don't use a lot of IV pumps. And so it is perfectly acceptable to just, you know, after that point, draw them up in syringes and push 10 milligrams of ketamine, 10 mics of Precedex. Some people will do it once an hour. Some people will wait till the patient has, you know, their heart rate or blood pressure start rising a little bit. That's sort of up to you. And also it has to do a little bit with how long your case is. If you're doing shorter cases, if you're doing our gallbladders, for instance, that's probably going to be about all you need to give right there. You may give, you know, like I said, 10 milligrams of ketamine, 10 micrograms of Precedex at the end of the case, or if on incision you have a little bit of jump in your heart rate, you can give a little bit more at that point. The other thing you might want to consider for these shorter cases is adding a little bit of magnesium between 2 to 4 grams. And, you know, you don't really want to push that in, but run it in over half an hour to an hour. You can add it to your first bag of fluids if you have the vials, or when your antibiotic's done, if you've got the 4 gram piggybacks, you can just use your secondary tubing to kind of titrate that in. And that will dramatically reduce the amount of ketamine and Precedex you need and the amount of pain that the patient has postoperatively. And so the way I kind of like to think about it is the more mechanisms of action I add, the better pain relief I'm going to have and the less of the sedating medications I'm going to need to use. So adding something like magnesium, especially to a shorter anesthetic, really reduces the amount of sedating medications and really kind of speeds my wake up. So that, I think that is like kind of the standard opioid-free anesthetic for shorter cases. When you're talking about a little bit of a longer case or a little bit of a more painful case, a lot of times we want to run infusions of those medications because, one, it saves us from having to constantly redose, but it creates that nice steady state plasma concentration of all these medications. And it actually becomes easier and far less time consumptive when you run an infusion because you're just sort of on autopilot. You know, you will find a lot of different ways to do this. One of the original researchers on opioid-free anesthesia, his name was Jan Mulier, M-U-L-I-E-R. And you can find sort of his recipe out there. There's a CRNA out of North Carolina by the name of Jason McLott. And he sort of popularized a technique that he calls the McLott mix. And I think he's even got a website, McCom or .net or something like that, that you can find his recipe on. I do it a little bit differently because the way I do it doesn't involve math. And so anytime I can like avoid having to do calculations, it makes my life so much easier and I'm so much less likely to mess things up. So what I'll do is I'll take 2% lidocaine and I will add 2 milligrams per milliliter of ketamine and 2 mics per milliliter of Precedex to it. So if I've got, you know, a 20 ml vial, that's 40 mics of Precedex, 40 milligrams of ketamine to that. And I will run it at 0.1 milliliters per kilo per hour. So 80 kilogram patient gets milliliters an hour. Really easy. There's no math involved. And you just run that through the case, turn it off, you know, when they start closing. And that's going to save you a lot of time and effort for those longer cases and especially for the really painful cases or the cases that have really stimulating portions.
Now, are you mixing this all in one syringe?
I am.
And for those who are listening, I am taking very detailed notes on what what Dr. Barabow is saying right now. And I'm going to put that in the show notes so everybody has a copy of all the dosages and everything. So for those who are also feverishly scribbling, it's okay. I got you. So longer cases, more painful cases, you're going to mix up this infusion. This is the mix that you like to do because it is much easier to calculate the math. But for those who, there are other options out there. You're saying there is another CRNA, the McLott mix as well.
Correct. And I even know people that will hang them all on separate pumps, you know, for like really long spine cases, open heart cases, things like that. But for what most of us are doing every single day, that's a level of control that we don't necessarily need to have. And what most of us need is, you know, something that is time efficient.
Right. Are those, so you went through lidocaine, ketamine, Precedex, magnesium. Are there any other medications that you use maybe sometimes or very occasionally, or is this pretty much it?
So, you know, on top of that, you want to do, that's mainly what I use as my intraoperative technique, what I would define as opioid-free anesthesia. You know, you still want to use the other medications that you think about for managing post-op pain, you know, Tylenol, big doses of steroids. If you're a patient that's going to be an inpatient, you know, consider a gabapentinoid. I know those have kind of taken a bad rap lately, but I think there's still a place for them for inpatients and for patients who are having surgery with high degrees of chronic post-surgical pain. So those types of things that you would, you know, as part of like the ERAS protocols or that you would give to help manage your post-operative pain, still use those medications. And The other one, so two other medications that you can consider using, number one being Esmolol. And sometimes you've got a case that you need to intubate, but there's not a lot of post-operative pain afterward. Hysteroscopies, ERCPs, even things like ablations. You can use Esmolol to help blunt the hemodynamic response to laryngoscopy without giving opioids. And the dose for that is anywhere from a half milligram per kilo to a milligram per kilo. So typically in that 50 to 100 milligram range. And sometimes I will use that to help reduce the amount of ketamine and Precedex I have to use for a really short case. Again, like hysteroscopies, maybe you have a general surgeon that does a lap appy in 20 minutes, right? And you don't want to give 50 of Precedex and 50 of ketamine to your patient because you're going to wake them up in 15 minutes, right? So you can cut the dose of Precedex and ketamine in half and sort of bridge that gap with some Esmolol.
Now, are you giving this all over the span of how many minutes? Because, you know, when I give Esmolol, it's like 10 milligrams at a time, right? But you're saying it's 100 milligrams. Are you giving this all at once over a couple minutes? What's the timing for that?
Yeah, IV push, you know, kind of like you give the rest of your induction medications. And okay. A dose like 100 milligrams, I would give a dose like that for a young, otherwise healthy patient that's getting an EGD or an ERCP, and I've got to intubate them for that. But I'm not going to give any other, I'm not giving ketamine, Precedex, all of those things. All I need to do is keep their heart rate down while I do the laryngoscopy, and then I'm going to turn the gas on, and that's going to, you know, cover stimulation after that point. And there's no real pain afterwards, right? So What I'm going to do, I'm going to, you know, 50 to 100 milligrams, I'm going to push that with my propofol, my lidocaine, my rocuronium, or whatever paralytic I'm going to use. And you'll start to see the heart rate start to drop a little bit. And then you stick the laryngoscope in their mouth and it stabilizes the...
I'm going to have to try it. I haven't tried it yet. I think I'm going to have be scared to push that Esmolol at first, but I'm going to be thinking about you. Like, just trust Tom. He says it'll be okay. So Esmolol, and then there was another medication that you use sometimes?
Oh, yeah. So the other medication you can consider is nitrous oxide. And a lot of people sort of gloss over the fact that nitrous oxide has a pretty strong analgesic aspect to it. And once you get to that 50% end tidal concentration, that's equivalent to about 15 milligrams of morphine. So again, when you have those shorter cases that you don't want to give a lot of ketamine and Precedex and the long-acting sedative agents to, you can use nitrous oxide to help bridge them intraoperatively.
Awesome. So, of course, as patients are starting to wake up from this type of anesthetic, I think that something that you always remind people of is that the respiratory pattern is going to be quite different when somebody wakes up from volatile agents as opposed to when somebody has volatile agents plus opioids. And what we're used to seeing is maybe normal to lower respiratory rates, right? But we've always learned when we give volatile anesthetics that volatile anesthetics make your respiratory rate high and your tidal volumes low. And so is this what we're going to be seeing now that opioids are not in the picture anymore?
Absolutely. And it is really scary the first couple times you do it, because it's very normal to have a respiratory rate between 20 to 30 when you first get your patient back breathing at the end of the case. And, you know, based on years of experience of giving opioid-based anesthesia, there's this voice in your mind that's saying your patient's in pain. They're going to wake up, you know, screaming in pain. The PACU nurse and all your coworkers are going to think you're a horrible anesthesia provider. What are you doing? and your hand will sort of try and like reach over for the Dilaudid against your sort of own volition. You know, you've got to kind of like hold yourself down a little bit and just sort of think through, okay, this is normal. You know, worst case scenario, the patient wakes up and I give some Dilaudid at that point. You know, once they're able to tell me I'm really hurting. So yeah, that respiratory rate really throws people and is very concerning the first couple times you do it. But then you get used to it and you recognize that that's just an effect of the volatile agent. Your patient's going to wake up fine.
So what do patients normally require postoperatively in that period? What do they look like? What do they require from the nurses? And what types of orders are you writing for the PACU nurses?
So I think the other thing you really have to understand is it does take your wake up a little bit longer from the time that you turn your gas off to the time that the patient opens their eyes and they're willing to follow commands. Takes about 5 minutes longer. So if you're in a facility where the practice is, you know, they've got to sort of do algebra before you're willing to extubate them. It's going to take you a couple cases to relearn when to turn the gas off to make your get back to that spot where they're opening their eyes as you're dropping the drapes and taking the tube. However, the interesting thing is that there's not that confused stage where, you know, they're not really following commands. They'll open their eyes, but they're kind of confused. They wake up very clear-headed, you know, just kind of ready to get up and go. And so it doesn't change your PACU times at all, because once they do open their eyes and wake up, assuming that you haven't given too much of the medications, you know, they're ready to go. Now, I would love to say that, you know, opioid-free anesthesia is this magical thing and that patients will never have pain and they always will just wake up pain-free and unicorns and rainbows. But, you know, they've had surgery and so, you know, there's still going to be pain. I'd say when you get used to this technique and get comfortable with it, your patients will have less pain than with a traditional opioid-based anesthetic. The other thing is that opioids are going to work a lot better in the postoperative period because you didn't load them up with high potency, high dose anesthetics in the intraoperative period. So you've avoided the opioid-induced hyperalgesia and the opioid tolerance that has built up. A lot of us, you know, we're sort of taught about those things. We're not taught that those are measurable effects at doses of 100 mics of fentanyl or 10 milligrams of morphine. I think we sort of learn about them and we think, oh, well, after 3 days of round-the-clock narcotics, they might need some more. No, it really doesn't take much at all for the tolerance to start to build up. So what you'll find is that even when you have patients that wake up with pain, you're going to need less Dilaudid postoperatively to manage that. And so for myself, my PACU orders, I've cut my Dilaudid dose down to a half milligram at a time. And so for one, that's safer because they don't have opioid-causing respiratory depression already in their system when they get that Dilaudid. They also don't need nearly as much of it postoperatively.
I agree with the literature, you know, that you were talking about the opioid-induced hyperalgesia occurs a lot faster than people think. I think traditionally when we learn about it, we just think about remifentanil infusions, high dose, long doses of remifentanil infusion. But the literature does show and the science does support that even after one dose of a medication, that the receptors can become desensitized and begin to downregulate. So like you said, even with those seemingly what we think are benign doses can change the response that people have in the postoperative period. So what you're saying is that by actually avoiding it in the intraoperative period, the smaller doses are more effective in the postoperative period. So it's not opioid-free for the entire hospital stay. It's a technique that you use as your anesthetic, and then when they're in the postoperative period, they are seemingly more comfortable.
Absolutely. And, you know, that sort of goes back to what we were talking about at the very start of this. The goal of opioid-free anesthesia isn't to avoid opioids at the expense of the patient. And what, you know, the literature is showing us is that if we avoid opioids at the expense of leaving our patients in pain, we're not doing any sort of benefits to them. But the other side of that coin is there are not really benefits to giving intraoperatively. Patients don't have less pain because of it postoperatively. And so postoperatively, when your patient's awake and they can say, I'm in pain, you have to treat that pain. Obviously, we want to do everything possible to have them not require opioids. Not because we have something against opioids, but because opioids have more side effects and complications than any other medication we can get. But we need to treat their pain aggressively. So do the blocks, do the multimodal, do the opioid-free anesthesia. And if they're still having pain, you want to treat that with an opioid and have your patients be comfortable.
So basically, think of opioids as more of a third line option as opposed to attacking it as a first line alternate, you know, option for that patient. So it's, you've tried all these things first, patients are still not comfortable, then you're trying the opioid, but at least, you know, you have tried other techniques that could have worked and avoided the opioid in the first place.
Right. And, you know, I think of it as opioid last anesthesia, where I'm using all these other medications to knock down the amount of pain that they have. And if they still have, if they're pain free, great. Or if they have mild levels of pain, great. We don't have to give them an opioid. If they're still having moderate to severe pain, give them an opioid and know that they'll have received or required less opioids, which reduces the risk of, you know, chronic post-surgical pain, of severe post-operative nausea, vomiting, of, you know, addiction or dependence or long-term opioid use, you know, all these other issues that we're facing that keep patients in the hospital, that drive up healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's lots of people that are great candidates for opioid-free anesthesia. Maybe we focus a little bit on who you think is maybe not a candidate for opioid-free anesthesia.
Sure. So we sort of have this term of opioid-free anesthesia, and in our mind that's sort of separated from an opioid-based anesthetic. But if we think about opioid-free anesthesia just as sort of multimodal analgesic therapy, we can add opioids on top of that if we need to and still get much better analgesia than either technique alone. So obviously the one that comes to mind is, you know, the patients who are on long-term opioid therapy for chronic pain. The last thing you want to do is stop giving those patients opioids. They need their normal doses and opioids on top of that. So I'm not going to give those patients an opioid-free anesthetic, but I'm still going to give them ketamine and lidocaine and magnesium as a multimodal technique. On top of that, you know, some of the patients who are on, you know, buprenorphine or some of those other medications, patients that have severe chronic pain, whether or not they're on an opioid or not, you know, their nervous system is already so upregulated, you know, they're able to experience pain at such a higher level than people who don't have that disease process. can experience it. And so, you know, I'm going to treat it like a multimodal analgesic anesthetic, where I'm giving them opioids, but I'm giving them these other medications as well.
It's an important point that you brought up with the people that are on long-term opioid therapy, especially high-dose opioid therapy. They really are a special population that it is, if you give them opioid-free anesthesia and you just completely negate, especially for a long case, that this person requires high doses all the time, you will put that person through withdrawal. And if you are not looking for, you know, the signs of withdrawal, and this could even happen intraoperatively. So the signs of withdrawal may look like, you know, signs of pain. You start to see diaphoresis, you start to see maybe some pupillary changes, you know, changes to vital signs. And you might start thinking to yourself, oh, maybe they're in pain, maybe they're waking up, when really they're going through opioid withdrawal. So yeah, that definitely a special population. We can certainly talk about those types of patients in future episodes. So just to wrap up the episode here, tell us a little bit about SOFA and, you know, a little bit about why somebody should join SOFA, the benefits that it provides. You provide a conference every year, which was amazing. And you invited me to speak at this year, which was awesome to meet so many people so passionate about the topic. So tell us about SOFA.
Yeah. So back in 2017, myself and several other CRNAs founded the Society for Opioid-Free Anesthesia. What was occurring was, you know, I was just starting to learn about opioid-free anesthesia, and I was talking about it with other CRNAs and anesthesia providers, and the outcomes I was getting and what the research was. And this was really when the opioid epidemic was starting to ramp up. And so there was a large number of patients who had become addicted and then gotten clean, and they were coming in having surgery. And one, you know, a lot of them are on medication-assisted therapy like Suboxone, so opioids were not being effective to treat their pain. And or they were coming in and saying, I don't want any opioids. You know, I don't want to risk relapse. And so the interest in opioid-free anesthesia, what I was talking about, just ballooned very, very quickly and got well beyond what I could handle myself. And so that's why I founded the organization, to provide that information to people who want it and need it. We, as a member of the society, you get access to, I want to say, 6 free CEs. We have an online video database that you can go and download various lectures on opioid-free anesthesia. So you get 6 free CEs that way, and the rest of them are at a discounted rate. You get a discount to our yearly conference. And so between those two things, the discount you get on both of those, that basically takes up your entire membership cost. So it's essentially like membership to SOFA is free if you take advantage of those two things. And that will get you around 25 CEs a year if you come to our conference and do the free online modules.
And the conference every year is at the same location, which is in Panama City, Florida. So I had the great pleasure of going there this year. And it's such a beautiful location, a beautiful campus at FSU, correct? Florida State University. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is. It is. I don't know how anyone goes to school there and does schoolwork. It's right on the beach. It's right on the water. It's absolutely fantastic.
I know. I was actually talking to Dr. Hodges, who is, I think, assistant PD there. And I said, do you just feel like you wake up every day and you're just in heaven going to, he's like, yeah. He's like, I've been offered some really very prestigious kind of positions within the profession. He's like, I've turned it all down because I just can't leave. Who would leave that place? It's beautiful. So yeah, definitely check out their website. And if you get an opportunity next year, think about coming to the conference. It's a really great time. It's at a beautiful location. And there's a lot of really, really excellent clinicians that come and speak at this event. So for the final takeaways, what's the main takeaway that you would give to people who want to learn this technique and want to incorporate it into their practice?
Yeah, learn as much as you can about it. Find those patients who will really benefit the most from it. Find those patients who are at high risk for respiratory depression, who have history of severe postoperative nausea, vomiting, patients who are undergoing major surgery, you know, whether it's, you know, radical mastectomies or major spine surgery or, you know, anything like that. Talk about it with your team, with the people around you. Find those patients and try it out. And, you know, those are the, when people see the success, when, you know, you have a patient who has been admitted for severe postoperative nausea, vomiting after every single surgery they've ever had, and you give them their first anesthetic where they don't have vomiting afterwards, that's a huge win. And you will start to buy the goodwill of the people around you, and people will start coming to you and asking you to do those cases and do that crazy voodoo anesthetic that you do.
Cool. Awesome. So if people want to get a hold of you and get a hold of the society, where can they find you?
Yeah. So the society's website is goopioidfree.com. You can email us there, info@goopioidfree.com. I am very active on social media. You can find me at BaraboOFA. And that's good for Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I don't use a whole lot of Twitter anymore, but I'm still on there occasionally. So feel free to reach out to me. I will gladly answer any questions you have.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.